All right. Welcome to another episode of the Joe and Doug Show. We are back after two long weeks separated.
Baby, I missed come you. Back.
You can blame it. Oh.
We get some Barry White kicking in here. Have a romantic time tonight.
You were away, and yes. I did two shows solo, which was a lot of fun. It was great having Pastor Michael in here, and then Sam T. I don't know if you got to watch the Sam T. show. We should definitely have him back on. You would totally connect and have a really good time. Cool. A business guy, entrepreneur, and really just a powerful story. It was really neat. Actually, Mario in post-production text me. He goes, "This was awesome. Love the interview of it," which was really cool. And I got several friends and compliments, and I actually shared the YouTube on LinkedIn because he does a lot of stuff on LinkedIn, so that it got a lot of likes there and picked up there, which was cool. But and then I was away, and so we've been two ships passing in the night. So you went up to Maine and Boston. Did you have lobster?
I had lobster.
Was it as amazing as everybody makes it out to be?
You know it. I had some locals that prepared it the proper way and did first we had a restaurant prepare day one's version of it. And then we just had a local prepare it their way where it was in beer and it was, done right. It was so good.
Yeah. Melting so your mouth. Good.
Yeah. They had a very specific, like, dip it in this and do this and do this. And I don't know. I just wanted to eat it. I didn't really care. So we did. They called them. They were. What they call them? Steamers. They called them steamers. I didn't know what steamers were. Right. They were just.
There's a restaurant.
I know, but I didn't make the connection. I thought, one was like a branding thing, but that was like noun. You know.
Yeah. No, that's cool. So you hit up Boston. What was your favorite history stuff that you hit? I was watching your Facebook and it was like picture. And I was like, Joe's going to come back with a, 3-point hat and,
right.
and a lantern and he's going to be ready to go.
You know it. I would say the John Hancock Memorial that we spent a lot of time in cemeteries there.
Yeah.
Right? Just checking out who was buried there. And you go into thinking like it's cool to see some old tombstones, but it hits you. It's a different feeling walking through that, just like how long ago and still the respects that are paid and the memorial, it's amazing place.
Yeah. So you did Boston, you did Maine, and where else did you go?
Then we went to New York
and
we hit the, the Grand Canyon of the East.
It's beautiful.
And it was amazing. Just cool times with my family.
Yeah. That's what it's all about. Well, the thing I want to talk about, so I experimented on my kids yesterday in the best possible way.
This is going to go the worst. This is, sounds terrible. Pray tell.
So, so my wife's away. Her sister had a baby, and so she's meeting our newest nephew. And so she took our youngest with her, and so I have the three oldest. So take her to the airport, get back, and I sit all my kids down Monday. I'm like, here's the plan for the week. And I was like, we're going to get some schoolwork done. They're not in school right now. I was like, we're going to get some reading done. You each have to do a book report.
Oh, no.
So I lay out all this stuff. And my kids are like, let's go. They're pumped.
Really?
Oh, pumped to do this.
Whoa.
So Graham wrote a story that he was pretty excited to read. Charlotte wrote a 10 sentence thing on white-tailed deer from memory. All these facts on white-tailed deer. Like, they were into this. But one of the things I said to Charlotte, she's about to go into fourth grade, and I said, sweetie, have you done social studies or history? She goes, well, I've done some social studies. I said, oh, what sort of stuff? And so she brought up Christopher Columbus, and she brought up some of the Black History Month stuff and Martin Luther King and different stuff like that, and all good stuff. And it was real, that when the holidays fall, they teach in social studies, and they get little snippets here and there. And our public school does a pretty decent job, and it's pretty balanced. It's thus far, it has not been slanted as far as I could tell. They did a decent job with it all. And so I said, well, I have these videos. I had not watched these videos in some time. And so I put the first one on, and the topic, though, led to a great discussion with my daughter. Because she was like, why do we have to learn about old stuff? And she was just kind of like not interested at this point. And the first video was entitled, it's a whole American history set. And I'm definitely geared for like high school students. We watched the first one and I was watching her eyes glaze over. I'm like, man, this is so good. But she was like, this is over her head. Yeah. But the question they asked in the beginning of the first video, and it's a setup for why you should watch the rest of them, is why is history important? And I think that's such an important thing for us to grapple with a little bit, because If you don't know where you came from, if you don't know your history, you're doomed to repeat it, that kind of thing. And so we went through that and we talked about a couple different things. She gave some great reasons, actually, as to why history was important. After she watched the clip and glazed over, she caught a few things, which was nice. But do you find history to be important, Joe? Why or why not?
No, not really.
Okay.
I like history and I have an appreciation. And when I disagree with that whole, you're doomed to repeat it.
Yeah.
Because it repeats regardless if you know it, because there aren't enough intelligent people to pay attention to it. You're like, oh, an iceberg. Here it comes. Should we turn? Nobody's smart enough to turn. So we hit it like, oh, I knew it all the time and I died. You know, well, what's the difference? You can't change it. We are. It should be like, you're doomed and you're doomed.
Doesn't matter if you remember or not, you're still going.
That's right. And then the people who are paying attention just got to watch it play out, like, you know, want to tell everybody about it. Nobody cares.
Mm. So
I'm sorry to rate on that. No, parade.
That's okay. If I hadn't been called in the ministry, I wanted to be a history teacher. I loved history. I loved that. You mentioned, before the show that you're probably going to do a trip to Gettysburg here soon. Love Gettysburg, Civil War. All of that's fascinating. Hopefully you find a musket ball. Bring your,
metal detector?
Go magnet fishing.
Magnet! Yes!
And bring the metal detector. Oh, you're going to find like a cannonball. You got to bring
totally.
That
home.
Totally. Don't tell nobody.
They will throw me in jail. Federal crime, baby.
But that'd be sweet. But I love history. There are cycles and there certainly are, when I was in Bible school and we learned biblical history, there were actually several cycles where you watched, the children of Israel obeyed God, walking in the promised land. Then they sinned and then they walked away from God. God punished them, sent them into captivity. Then he delivered them, brought them back to the land. And you watch the cycle and you would wish, like, please, somebody read the text. Like, you guys are going through the same thing you went through. Very similar right? to what you're saying there. But when you look at different types of spaces in history, I just think it's so important because what you believe about history and what you believe about the past oftentimes determines what you'll end up, how you'll end up living your life in the future. So if you believe certain things about the past, that determines certain things about today.
Right.
This is the big argument right now with critical race theory and some of that stuff in the 1619 Project versus actual American history and some of that stuff that's just been put out there. And you look at what's being propagated and what's being taught and you look at what was being taught too. And I'm not saying that there's a perfect version of history because everybody's looking at it through their particular set of lenses. But an honest broker can look and go, all right, you know what? I see that version and I see these gaping holes in over here or that slant to it. And it certainly sets us up on course. There's a reason biblically God tells us over and over again, remember, tell your children, don't forget. He does that over and over and over. Now, the people almost always forgot and repeated it, but that's why he kept saying it. He's like, if you remember this, you won't repeat it because you remember what slavery was like. They have a whole, a whole meal, the Passover Seder is to remind them. They eat bitter herbs. They eat all sorts of, food to remind them of what it was like to be in slavery so that they never go back there again. So, I mean, even the rituals and the stuff that, the meals and those sort of things are set up to remind them, this is what happened. You don't want to go back there. And I just find similar to what you said, you either have a fatalistic approach, like, hey, it's going to happen anyway, and I can yell all I want about it, but it's still going to come down the pike. But I want to believe that if I can look at history and I can see those things, that I can allow that their ceiling to become my floor. I can do more today because of the past. And I think you have an edge of that to you, even though,
on a personal level, when you back up from a million miles away, sure. Like I have up on the screen right here, have you ever seen the cycle of civilization? Yeah, one of my favorite things to study.
100%.
And so what you can't see it at home. There's basically a cycle that all civilizations follow and it's completely logical and mathematically you can make some drawing out of it of why that ends up. So right. You have from bondage basically to spiritual faith. All right. You picture a moment in history where people were enslaved and then what got them out of that was tying together against all odds, having sticking together and pulling themselves out. Then spiritual faith comes great courage. Then you have the Renaissance Then you have Courage to Liberty, where once we've broken out, then we're going to establish ourselves and give freedoms that we didn't have when we were in bondage. From liberty to abundance, that liberty grows the abundance, right?
Yep.
And then what do you think happens after the abundance? You get complacency, because abundance buys complacency. Complacency to apathy, of course, 100% connected, that once you have all that you need and everything is unlimited, that you get complacent and apathetic. And then the apathetic then creates dependency, because now we've given away the freedoms that we fought so hard to earn, and you go right back in bondage again.
Yeah. No, and you definitely see that throughout civilization. We could look at ancient Rome, Greece, wherever you want to go.
Yep.
They all follow. They may skip a step here or there, but it's pretty cyclical in that sense. And I think it's interesting if you look at, you know, the founding of our nation, and you look at even just the Declaration of Independence. You know, if you ask 90% of Americans out there, why did we break away from England? What's their response? Taxation without representation, right? It's a very economic view of the Declaration of Independence. Now, have you ever read the Declaration of Independence?
Oh, I haven't, no.
So there's actually 27 reasons that they give for breaking away from England. Taxation without representation is number 17, right? There were 10 or 11 that were about governmental abuse. And the fact was they were passing laws, and then England was saying, we don't care. We're going to, you can't do that. Pennsylvania actually in 1774 tried to abolish slavery, and the king said nope. So I mean, this whole concept that like the founding fathers all wanted slavery and stuff like that, there were four or five states that had banded together to form abolition movements, and the king wouldn't let them form those. And so those were all part of those grievances, along with the abuse of military power, religious freedom. They wanted them to worship in the Church of England. They didn't want to have other churches and stuff like that set up. And so There were so many other reasons, but the one you're taught in school is the economic one,
right?
Taxation without representation. It's a very narrow view. And if you actually look at the Declaration of Independence, you know, it's like I said, it's like number 17, and it's not even in the top five, let alone, you know, it's on the list and it's important, but a lot of them were spiritually based. The fact that in the original draft of the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson had a whole thing in there about abolishing slavery, but South Carolina and Georgia really opposed that. And so he had to use softer language to get them on board. It was a compromise they made. And, you know, thank God for, you know, the Civil War and the fact that we went through what we went through with that. But when you look at that, you know, we're taught that snippet in history. So everybody comes out of public school education and goes, well, we broke away from England because of a tea tax, you know, taxes. They were screwing us over. And it was like, well, no, that was one thing, but there were a whole bunch of things that we didn't like. It's similar in the church world. Like Martin Luther started the Protestant Reformation. There were really only a couple of types of churches. Obviously the Catholic Church was huge, and you had some Orthodox and other styles of churches. But up until that point, you didn't have a Protestant church. And Martin Luther was a Catholic priest who said, hey, here are 95 things that are wrong with the church, and I think we should fix them. He didn't actually, it's called the Reformation because he wanted the church to reform. But the one or two that people remember, like indulgences or whatever, he had 95 things that he was not happy about. And that's what happens. We microcosm and we shrink things down to fit an agenda rather than learning the all-encompassing. I actually just bought a copy of the Declaration of Independence.
Did you really? I'm so impressed with you, man.
So my wife has, when her dad passed, she inherited a map of Philadelphia from like, I don't know, the 1800s or late 1800s. It's really cool and it's huge. And I was like, that's going to look sweet on that wall. I'm like, I need a copy of the Declaration of Independence to go next to that.
We can go steal it.
Get Benjamin Franklin's glasses.
But okay, let's go over here. Now, you talked about two things, and I want to just sort of like expand it, that let's just say England, you know, total tyranny, right? Mm-hmm. So in this deal, you have bondage, tyranny equals bondage, right? So when you had control of England, he could totally, you know, impose his will.
Yeah.
But then you had this breakout thing that was thousands of miles away, and then the tyranny was lost by that sort of spatial control. And so, like, even what you were saying, even within the church reformation, you had tyranny and you had breakout because of the tyranny.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in, you know, a political separation like we had, little different in the sense that, like, in the religious sense, like, there wasn't a church down the road for you to go. So, like, when Martin Luther posted his 95 theses, they put this council together called the Diet of Worms. It was there in Germany, and they put him on trial, essentially, and they excommunicated him, said he was going to hell, and he wasn't allowed to get communion, he wasn't allowed to go to church. And so where he wanted to see the church change and be more biblical and founded more on scripture, and he brought his complaints to the church, not because he wanted to start his own church, but now we have the Lutheran church for a reason. He was like, well, if you're going to kick me out, I guess I have to start my own. And there's a lot of his theology that other people didn't, but he was kind of the first, you know, domino in that. And then somebody else was like, well, you know, this isn't biblical either. And then you started getting, you know, so many tiers later, right, of all sorts of stuff. And then with the emergence of America, you know, Manifest Destiny and so many things that came into Christian theology for good and for bad. And then, you know, you have what you have today, which is a whole smorgasbord of all different stuff from traditional to, you know, I wear jeans and a t-shirt. Hallelujah.
Right. So, all right. So on this, if you were to say, take your mall map and say, you are here, and we're going to go through this exercise here. So if you were to say, you know, you have somewhere between what, complacency, apathy, where we are in our civilization,
America right now.
Yeah.
100% somewhere between selfishness and apathy.
Okay. Selfishness. So if I told you
at best, people are selfish to get their own. At worst, they're complacent or apathetic.
Okay, so we're gradient between those.
Yeah.
Now, if you said that this circle just plays out over and over again, and we can stop this, all we have to do is what?
Vote the right people in, Joe.
Wait, where's my buzzer? So if you were to warn them.
I had to hit that one.
If you were to say that we can short circuit this and go beyond and say, okay, let's go right from apathy, that we're not going to give up our freedoms, we're not going to go into bondage, we're not going to have to go through that revitalization, we could short circuit right to courage, what would you tell people to even do?
It's one of the reasons I do what I do. I believe the local church is the hope of the world. I think Jesus put it on the earth for a reason. He said, I'll build my church and the gates of hell won't prevail against it. There have been so many people that have said, oh, the church is going to be dead. I think it was I don't know if it was Nietzsche or Voltaire, one of those guys said, oh, the church is going to be dead in the next 50 years. He died and the American Bible Society bought his house and prints Bibles out of it. And I just think that's awesome. To get to that spiritual faith, for me, that's the only starting point for this. You look at the Great Awakenings, Plymouth Rock. The reason they left, and I know everybody wants to make everything economic today, which is why you only get the taxation without representation thing. They came over. If you read the charter of Jamestown and the 1607 colonies, like, most of their charter was about the spread of the gospel and, taking the kingdom of God further. And then there was some other stuff like, hey, we'd really like to make some money and there's business opportunity and ventures, but they were way down on the list. But the only thing that current history is going to tell you is, oh, they were just there to make money. They were sponsored by business people. If you read their charter, you read the Mayflower Compact, and you read, some of the, writings of some of the pilgrims that came over, they were fleeing religious persecution and they wanted to be able to worship God and establish his kingdom here. So that spiritual faith side of things always presses the boundaries for people to go further, and revival's the only thing I think that starts the clock over again, if that makes sense.
Okay, so we're in an apathetic stage. Apathy does not breed proactivity, right? Wait until it's too late and say, man, I wish it would have done. So if you're at the driver's seat trying to get that revitalization, and you need to inspire. So you inspire before something's necessary, or you say, man, we wish it would have done it. How do you hit the gas pedal on the do it before you have to, too late? You have
to create urgency. That's the number one responsibility of any leader, is to create urgency, whether you're creating urgency to buy a product that people really want. But I think the greatest urgency in the nonprofit sector and churches, schools, etc., is the urgency for change, right? We all wait till we have to change. But to create that urgency for people to realize, like, hey, the drug addiction problem we have right now is, like, not okay. So what do? Like, we can sit here and complain about it. We can throw money at it. Or we can start a recovery night. We can start a recovery ministry. All right. So we helped 50 people. Well, 50 more than one. Pastor Michael shared this when he was on the show, a week ago or so, the story of the kid, walking along the shore with his grandpa, and the starfish are getting washed up on the shore, and his grandpa's looking at him, and he's like, you know, all these starfish are going to die. And he starts picking them up and throwing them back in. And he's like, hundreds of starfish. You're like, you're not gonna be able to save everyone. And the kid picks it up and he goes, but I can save this one. And it's that sort of mentality that, if we can step out and, if everybody does something, that changes things. But you have to create a sense of urgency. Nobody changes unless there's urgency.
So do you take what we talked about a couple of weeks ago, where you take the most appalling version of what bondage looks like, and you say, if you want to go there, this is what it looks like. This is what it smells like. This is what your experience is going to be like, unless you get on this train.
And I think you have that happening right now in a political sense. It's why we're so divided, right? The left in the country has painted one picture and the right has painted another, and they're both painting this dire picture of what America is going to look like or what it is. And, you know, in one instance, America's this, 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 and this, and the other instance, it's this, this, and this. And if you vote for our guy or our gal, then we'll save the country. And that's literally what they're doing. So we have to paint that picture to create urgency to drive voters to vote for us. And unfortunately, that's the mechanism. You know, people aren't driven by statistics. They're just not. Behavior's not driven by that. It's not driven by facts. It's not driven by reason. It's not driven by logic. It's all driven by emotion. And so that's why we have the news media that we do. That's why we have all that stuff. And I'm not saying we should manipulate those things, but that's how we make decisions. That's why, you know, you never hear anybody say like, well, I crunched all the numbers and I still feel terrible about this decision, but we're going to do it. Most people are like, you know, that just feels right.
We factor. Yeah.
Yeah. We looked at that, or you know what? All the numbers make sense, but it just doesn't feel right. I'm not going to do it. We do that because emotions aren't made from a logical era. Decisions aren't made from a logical standpoint. They're not, I mean, you can look at it in your brain. They're just not made in that spot. And so we have to create a sense of urgency that taps into those heartstrings that says to people like, this is not okay. And unfortunately, everybody has a different level of faith where you stop believing. Everybody has a different tipping point for that. So some people are cool. I mean, they're in the apathetic stage and it's like, might as well preach to that wall over there. A pastor that I know through other pastors, he pastors a larger church now, a couple thousand people. And but when the church was a few hundred people, he was getting frustrated because he felt like the church wasn't listening to him. And so he preached a whole sermon with his back to the congregation, to the wall, and he told the church he had a better shot at the wall doing what he said than the church. And I was like, whoo. But you know, he's creating a picture with that, and he's creating an emotion and an urgency. And sure, some people may have been like, well, that guy's a jerk, I'm gonna go to another church. But there were other people that, man, that cut them deep. And all of a sudden it was like, I have to move. Like, I can't, that can't be me. And so tapping into that stuff, it's the power of story. It's why we use you know, testimony, and you use that stuff because people hear that and go, well, I can change. It's possible for me, whether that's whatever, drug addiction, my marriage could be saved, healing, et cetera. You know, when you talk about a country in general, I mean, you're talking about seven areas of culture that have to shift, from entertainment to education to politics to the religious spectrum that some people call the seven mountains of culture. And so, unfortunately, the church used to start all the schools, right? Harvard, Princeton, I mean, go down the list. They were all started for seminaries to train ministers. They've all gone a long way from that. The church used to be the leader in medicine. Church used to be the leader in a lot of things.
And it was the community center. Yeah. Like when you had a lunch or a meeting or whatever, where was it at? Center of your community at the church.
But over time, the church advocated its leadership role in that and said, oh, you know, that's for teachers to do, and that's for this person to do, and that's, we just take care of the spiritual realm. And then even the spiritual realm has been relegated to, oh, that's for your private life, don't share that with anybody. And when in actuality, that's why these different areas get hijacked. It's one of the reasons, honestly, I love the Daily Wire. Like, Ben Shapiro's putting out movies and stuff now because he's realizing, like, hey, we have to win the culture. We have to win. There's other spots in here. It's one thing for me to get on here and rant on a podcast about what I think.
Do you think stuff like that do you think it just consolidates people who are already in that camp, or do you think it recruits?
That's a good question. Does it just create another echo chamber?
Because I mean, honestly, when we broke off, we took the people who were pro and we just had the pro people to go do the thing. Right. And if you followed, cool. If not, you can go always go back to England if you want.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's, you know, sure. it would. OK, so if you ask the community and say, hey, do you want the church to be the center of the community again?
Yeah.
What would they say? Is it a demand issue where that they had an appreciation for it being there?
Well, I think it's been hundreds of years since it's been the case. And the vast majority of people don't even know what that looks like. When they see that, they have a YouTube picture of what could be. And some of the role models and caricatures of what could be in terms of preachers and churches, you know, don't give a glamorous they give a glamorous, but not a good representation of what that's supposed to look like. And I think it's just a matter of stepping in and doing what you're supposed to do. I've said for the last 2 years, if the church would be the church, I mean, that's literally what I believe the world's waiting for. You know, for the church to not just sit behind its walls. And I'm not just talking about going out and telling everybody about Jesus and the gospel, but like feeding people, clothing people. Like the only reason we have social services, I believe, is because the church has failed to do its job. Like if we did took care of the widow, the poor, and the orphan, like if we like took that scripture in James 1:27 where it says pure religions take care of the widow, the poor, and the orphan, and we just took that one, there'd be no need for welfare assistance. There'd be no need for that sort of stuff. But unfortunately, you know, we've given those parts up and go, oh, well, you know, the government takes care of that. And you know, it's an uphill climb at this point. Because we've given up so much ground. It's like, how do you get that back?
Right. And I think, it, you know, the church was inundated with marketing against. I think the way you bail yourself out of this is you tell the story and market for. And it's going to take just as many years to get back into that influence as it took to take it away.
The only X factor we have is the Lord. and he can speed things up. You know, you look at the Great Awakenings, you know, some of those preachers, Finney preached 80% of the city of Philadelphia heard him preach at one point. I mean, you think about that just in context of sheer number. Now some of that is because sure. Did word get out? Did stuff happen? Yeah. But, some people were coming cause he was entertaining. Some people were coming because, well, everybody else is going. Like it hit this tipping point culture wise where it was important. And then some people were watching their alcoholic father get delivered and they were like, whoa, what's going on? And that's there's the whole new thing. Recruits
when magical spiritual things start 100%. Happening.
When the thing that brought people into Jesus's ministry was, you know, they were like, yeah, that guy who's hasn't been able to walk in 37 years, we've all been walking past him. Jesus just walked by and said, pick up your mat and walk. And everybody went, we've watched him sit there for 37 years. Like that does something. And so the miracles always made room for the preaching. And the church is more about entertainment today than, anyway.
Yeah, and I don't necessarily mind that. I mean, there's always going to be an entertainment when you're in comparison. But like we do historical thing and we look at like how things were when you had somebody who would give their life and almost like a 1% chance of surviving. And it's tough to put yourself in what would motivate that person to feel so strongly about their belief to do something like that. And that to me, like, is miracle worthy, you know? So the next miracle might not be a miracle other than somebody gets in their heart to do something selflessly to that level, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's the William Wallace. It's you know, those sort of stories that inspire us. And here's the thing, everybody wants to be William Wallace until you have your balls cut off to use until you have to go to the torture rack and be disemboweled.
Yeah. Like, hey, we're going to put this document together and all of us are probably going to be killed. Everybody cool with that still? Right? I'm out, guys. Netflix is starting tonight.
I mean, you even think about the founding fathers. I mean, being up in Boston, how much they went back and forth and had they do things in secret and, you know, one of the, you know, they pledged to one another their wealth, their sacred. Most of them became broke because of the revolution. Like they put everything on the line because they believed in this. And unfortunately, when you're the hand-me-down recipient of something, you don't appreciate the blessing as much as the person who gave up everything for it. And you see that, you know, in generational wealth, right? Dad that came up from nothing, works his tail off, builds, you know, an empire, then passes it to his son who passes it to his son. And then his third or fourth generation squanders it because they don't have an appreciation for, you know, working midnights and having blisters on. There's a certain level of like chip on the shoulder and grit that you miss in that. And, you know, we're you know, almost 300 years, you know, or 270 some years away from the founding. And so there's just certain things we don't appreciate anymore. Like, you know, I don't have any relatives that I know that fought in the Revolutionary War. And like, I'm not connected to that. And, you know, I barely can go back to World War II, let alone, and it's just different. And so we have a real privileged and kind of spoiled generation that doesn't understand what they have.
Right. And when I would, I guess, you know, John Hancock, that stood out for me in that tour, because I fancy myself a John Hancock of this. Okay. Kind of given the moment to be able to double middle finger the tyranny, you know, tyranny, I would totally do it and write my name super big.
Yeah. Yeah. Herbie Hancock. every time I think of that, Tommy Boy comes to mind.
Herbie Hancock.
John Hancock. but that's the thing. And you saw that in Rome, like when entertainment takes over, you know, it's the slow march of society into that apathy and complacency, because we'd rather be entertained than fight for something that matters. I heard a preacher say one time, you know, most guys grow up wanting to be the hero and save the princess from the castle. The problem is our culture's taught them to sit on the couch and do it with their thumbs than actually go out there and change the world. And I was like, ooh, that's rough, but it's good.
Yeah.
And
I think like even my contributions to the overall schema of things, you almost feel a little embarrassed about how little impact you made over those selfless things. I mean, taking care of your family and your community is one thing, but you know, the acts that your previous generations throughout, they're like, I'm leaving the farm today. You guys are going to be okay. Might not ever see you again. Goodbye. You know, I don't know if I'd be willing to like to pull one of those out right now, unless, you know, and they couldn't see the landscape of how this was going to go down. Yeah. It might've been a fruitless to go against King George. Right.
Yeah. Well, even I shared a couple of weeks ago, we had a missionary from India that shared at our network conference in May. And he was saying that the COVID outbreak is just horrible there, and they don't have the equipment that they need, and people are just dying without, they can't get oxygen. They like simple things that we can get here and take for granted. They don't have access to a lot of those things. And he said there are whole groups of churches, pastors, Christians that are going into the hospitals knowing full well they're going to get COVID and die just to share the gospel with people. And I was like, I don't know if I do that.
Right.
Like,
right. Like exactly.
Like that, and that stings, because I want to say like, sign me up, but I'm like, I have four beautiful kids. I have responsibility. Like I have all the justification in the world. But man, like, you know, it so cut me when he shared that story. But that's the sort of stuff that we're talking about. Like these guys, whether you're talking about the, you know, founding of the country and the Revolutionary War, like they knew, like they could all hang. Like it was not, it wasn't like a fun social club. Like, just kidding, King George. Like your name was on a list.
And you lean on those guys. They weren't in an apathetic state. So they were ready to go roll down. Here it's like, if it's convenient, if it happens exactly at 9 o'clock.
If I can get enough clicks.
If I can get
the right picture at the right time.
Or else, out.
Yeah. It's a very different culture that we're in. And if we can't stir people to have an urgency and that spiritual revival that I'm believing is coming, I don't see how we pull out of this any other way.
Yeah. And I picture the reason I asked the question to you, like I did, was, you know, you're driving that train. You're going to, you know, do what you think is right. And you're going to be the church, and you're going to, you know, then guys like me are going to stand up and be able to tell a story that then gets more people on that train. And I think it's going to be lots of different functions in it. I don't think it's going to be like a single primary leader. It's going to be a ton of different people. Be. And think of like selflessly giving into a thing that has that much motion. It's not one person. You know what I mean? It becomes bigger. And that maybe that's our next civil, you know, whatever, revival.
Yeah, it has to be. And what's so fascinating to me, when you listen to church leaders, and I'm around a lot of them, everybody talks a certain way because they've read The Guys Who Gave Up Everything. But man, there's a different atmosphere to it when you give up everything. There's just something we spout rhetoric, and then our people go, oh, this is good. We sing about it. We talk about it. We hear about it, but nobody does it. And then when we get that person that does it, we're like, whoa, they're radical. I was like, no, like that's normal. And if we can switch that kind of connotation for ourselves and understand it's normal. I mean, the disciples gave up everything. They gave up their businesses. They gave up and they just dropped it all and they went and followed him. You know, that stuff's normal. and, well, you know, I got to make sure I got to take care of this. And I, you know, and I get that we have responsibilities. I'm not leaving my children, you know, but the Lord could call, the Lord could, you know what I mean? There's certain things in there that you look at and you go, man, people have done some crazy things for that. And if people are willing to do it for a nation, why not more for the kingdom of God? And that's just me as a pastor saying that, you know,
it's heavy, man. This yeah. is, this is good stuff.
Well, and it's, yeah, I'll go here.
do it, man.
So, you know, one of the things that I learned from you in talking about finance, I was always like so nervous to talk about it because I cared about the person. I didn't want to push an agenda. I didn't want to do that. But I'm like, you know what? Stinking like at the end of this, God owns it all. He's going to do, he wants his kingdom to advance. Like, I'm giving you an opportunity. Like, forget this. Like, I'm not begging from you. Like, this is an opportunity for you to be a part of a miracle.
Amen.
Like, if you want to be a part of a miracle, great. If you don't, keep it. I don't need it. God's going to provide it anyway. And it really put a switch in me to be like, you know, if you're going to sit around and thumb and hem and haw and, well, I can't give $500 or I can't give $10,000 to help this or whatever. Like, I don't need, if you're going to hesitate, like at the end of the day, the money has you, you don't have the money. And that's a huge distinction in this. And it really helped me push past that, because if the ultimate goal is to set the world on fire in a good way, then why wouldn't, like,
well, you were challenged and said, okay, so you're apathetic just like everybody else. Mm-hmm. We can't help it but not be. Mm. And the inconvenience of getting in someone's face and saying something that's less than what they want to hear, it pushes a little little buttons with people. Yeah. And you were like, screw it, I'm gonna do my thing. That's your standing up and saying what you believe in.
Yeah, no, I
give you a lot of credit for that.
We're I just wrote a letter sitting in the parking lot. I got here a little early because we have to expand the parking lot. We only had 5 spaces left on Mother's Day, and $75,000. And in my head, I'm facing the FUD, the fear, uncertainty, and doubt. But I'm like, you know what? Bump this. I was like,
did you say bump this?
Bump this.
Is that your like euphemism? Is it bump? Is that like I guess I fill in my own?
Yeah, I guess you can substitute your own 4-letter word in there if you like.
Bump this.
Yeah. I had a mentor and a preacher that would say what the rip all the time and what the lead. I always thought that was funny. I golfed with a pastor that every time he'd miss a shot, you know, a lot of guys, you know, haven't golfed until they swear. But I was with a pastor friend, and every time he'd miss a shot, he'd be like, your mom. And he hit the golf club down, always cracked me up. When you look at something like that, you know, I'm sitting there going, well, it's my brain. It's summertime. It took us 4 months to raise $40,000 last time. This is $75,000. We need it in 7 weeks. My brain's going all the reasons we're not going to get it, because I made this declaration, put the thing out there, and but at some point I'm learning. At some point, I have to be like, you know, either God wants to do this or he's not, or he doesn't. And if he's in on this $75,000, he'll write one check and it'll be done. You know, I didn't even release it. I told our team I was going to release it, and I already had leaders on Sunday being like, hey, I'm here. Here's your first spot. I'm bringing the second spot. I'm bringing the third spot. And so we're already, money's already coming in. I haven't even sent a letter yet. I haven't even asked for it. But I still have to I'm still flesh and blood. So I still have to fight that.
It's forever. You don't ever not go through that. Yeah. That's part of being human there.
Well, I just think it gets bigger. That's the thing I'm learning. So, I remember the first project I ever did at the church, we raised $11,000 to get new chairs and paint the kids area, because it was dingy. And we were like in folding chairs from 1953 that like you'd get tetanus being scratched by. They're just not in good shape. And I remember putting that out there to raise $11,000. And I was like dying in my office. Like, how are we going to do this? I mean, it was like, not in my mind, this was not going to happen. I don't know how. And sure enough, it came in just in the nick of time and all that. And I sweated through that, but it's gradually grown. And I'm finally to a spot now where I'm like, you know, yeah, 75,000 seems to some people maybe a ton, but you know, you and I've had those conversations. We have a business team, and I want to do $1 million church. I want to do a $10 million thing. And if we're going to do that, $75,000 is a drop in the bucket. And if we're going to balk at that, this is just strengthening my muscles for the next thing and strengthening the church's muscles for the next thing. It's a small step, and it'll be done here in the next 6 or 7 weeks. But you still go through that fear, uncertainty, and doubt because it's how you strengthen your faith muscle.
Yeah, and it's reality so that you know where your limitations. When you write 75,000 on the whiteboard, you believe it and you have faith in it, but it still has some draw on you. But if you were like, I'm going to raise $100, you wouldn't have that same effect because you just know that one. The faith has already been. Exactly. So you're right. A decimal point, just decimal point, and you'll get there. It's just as much as you will believe.
Yeah, no, it's 100% true. And I sat down with two different guys. One just wrote his first book, and another helps pastors write books. And I've been working on Law of Faith, Mechanics of Faith kind of book because it's been such a huge help for me and putting words to it and everything else to help people see, like, you know, just because you look at America right now and you see, you know, the apocalypse coming and all this sort of stuff, like at some point you're going to have self-fulfilling prophecy, like, or we can change the course. And we can step out and we can believe and we can do that. It's one of the things that I've loved about entrepreneurs, and the more entrepreneurs I get around and the more leaders like that, they don't care who's in the White House and they don't care what inflation's doing and they don't care, you know, if it's a good time, a bad time, if the economy's good. Like, they just care about doing what they're passionate about and they want to make the world a better place. They want to make some money. And don't get me wrong, they're not trying to lose money in this, but the drive is not to make a dollar. You know, everybody puts it out there like, you know, everybody owns business, you know, they're greedy, and you know, they have that they put that caricature out there. But the more entrepreneurs I get to know, like, they're just pumped to change the world in some way.
Yeah, be nimble and do what you love and the rest figures itself out.
Yeah, it's awesome. And I believe with all my heart that we can change this thing. We just have to create the urgency to change.
That is what I'm most interested about, the strategy behind it, because I mean, we can do like spreadsheets and figure out whatever,
sure,
but the urgency, like the, because you inspire by either putting something out of what could be or putting out what could be. And it's on either side of that. Yeah. One is going to be more motivating than the other.
Yeah.
And you know, what I always want to do is I want to put the target, the where we want to end up. And hopefully it's glamorous enough to get you to be uncomfortable for a while to be able to get there. But an apathetic thing, the motivator might be the other side. So how do you paint the picture of the brimstone, right? That motivates. Yeah. I don't want to be that guy, but I'm interested to see which one comes out.
Yeah, no, that's so good. Well, we had a fun show today. I will tell you, Thursday, you guys don't want to miss Thursday. My friend, Rabbi Walicki from Beth Shemesh, just outside of Jerusalem in Israel, is here in the United States. He's going to be in the studio with us, and we are going to chat with him all things Israel, Jewish Christian relations, et cetera, et cetera. And we're just going to have a fun time getting to know him. And I think you guys will have a lot of fun. So tune in on Thursday back here for the Joe and Doug Show with Rabbi Walicki. It's going
to
be good.
Thank you for listening to this show on Youngstown Studio. If you like our programming, we invite you to subscribe to our YouTube channel, follow our Facebook page, or subscribe to your favorite podcast platform like iTunes or Spotify. This is original Youngstown content, and we would appreciate you sharing the videos and the word about us. Thank you.